The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Georgine Rice. This week, the U.S. Senate votes to pass the Respect for Marriage Act.
What they're trying to do here, beyond what they say publicly, is that this is really an attempt to target people of faith.
We'll talk about why it matters.
This is one of those moments that's going to shape religious liberty for generations.
Including analysis from Albert Mohler.
The logic behind this kind of effort, and you see it in these Democratic statements, the logic behind it simply means there is basically a forfeiting of any claim to marriage as any kind of objective reality. It just means whatever some legislature, some culture may say, it means this for now, we'll see about later.
We've got all this and more. I'm Georgine Rice, and I'm glad to be with you once again. I'm coming to you from Portland and my home station of KPDQ. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website at kpdq.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. We'll begin in Washington, D.C., where on Tuesday this week, the U.S. Senate passed the Respect for Marriage Act. And let me warn you not to be fooled by the Orwellian language. The bill does nothing to strengthen marriage between one man and one woman. So what does it do? We'll start with Rob Bluey of the Heritage Foundation. He was a guest of Kevin McCullough on AM 570, The Mission, in New York City.
This vote that went down in the Senate, and they got 12 Republicans to sign on to the kind of pro-same-sex marriage legislation, this is headed to the current Congress next week. And will be easily probably passed. That means the president's going to sign it. What's the outcome of this legislation? What will this legislation change nationwide for states across the board?
The bottom line is that the legislation repeals the Defense of Marriage Act. That's a bill that was passed during the Clinton administration and supported by many Democrats, including our current president and former Democratic president, Bill Clinton. And so it just goes to show how much has changed in our culture just since that short time ago. And there is a concern on the part of Democrats, although I think that they have another agenda at play, that the Supreme Court, as it did with Roe v. Wade, could one day overturn the Obergefell decision, which legalized same-sex marriage nationwide. And so what they're attempting to do here is have Congress, on the record, pass a bill, which is deceptively named the Respect for Marriage Act, that would codify this in law. And there is, as you said, 12 Republicans, three of whom are retiring and won't even have a seat in 3 days, who were enough to give this the 62 votes that it needed initially to pass the test. In the Senate, as we know, it requires a higher threshold of 60. The House, as you indicated, is just a simple majority. So we expect it to pass the House and make its way to President Biden's desk and sign into law, unfortunately.
So in reality, it doesn't affect anything immediately, but it does do what Biden talked about with Roe, and that is it codifies Obergefell, and there would be no recourse for individual states to be self-determining on the issue beyond that point.
There is nothing that if you are a same-sex couple today and you're worried about, you know, losing some rights, it doesn't do anything to change that because the Supreme Court has already made that decision. But what they're trying to do here and why we think that they have other aims beyond what they say publicly is that this is really an attempt to target those people of faith who and the religious organizations and others who believe in traditional marriage between one man and one woman. And the reason that they will now be in the crosshairs of not only individuals on the left who might bring lawsuits or even the IRS, which could revoke their tax exempt status for many of these nonprofits, is that the bill does not provide sufficient protections to shield them from these potentially abusive lawsuits, which could cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars, particularly if you are a religious affiliated school or a charity or you handle adoptions and you maybe only provide support for, you know, parents who are a mom and a dad. You know, there are any number of scenarios that could potentially play out. And we have already seen, Kevin, I should mention, play out, whether it be Jack Phillips, the cake baker in Colorado,
right,
or Sussman, the florist. I mean, these individuals have not wanted to participate in same-sex marriages, and they have been forced by the state in some cases to force them to do that. And their cases have gone to the Supreme Court. So we worry that you will see more and more of that in the days to come as a result of this action.
So let me play chess instead of checkers here for a second. Is there discussion about challenging the constitutionality of this legally? Are there people, are there organizations that are interested in litigating the constitutionality of this measure currently, but can something be done to neutralize it ahead of time?
Yes, and in fact, you've seen some success on a separate issue, the President Biden's student loan forgiveness. Remember, that was one that he implemented through executive order. There were a number of individuals and state attorneys general that immediately took action in the courts, and there was a judge who put it on hold. So, I mean, there are opportunities to do exactly what you're doing. I think that the important thing is to find the right plaintiffs, find the right individuals who would have standing in a court of law and be able to do exactly what you're talking about. And there are efforts already underway to do that, because the path here is inevitable. The president has said he's going to sign it, and Democrats still have control of the House until January 3rd. So, you know, they will do this in the lame duck session of Congress. So that is one course of action. I think that the other thing that we just need to be aware of, particularly as we look to the future, but Senator Mike Lee put forward an amendment, which is called the First Amendment Defense Act, which received the support of every Republican but one and Joe Manchin. So there now, this is a bill that he has been fighting for over a half dozen years, and just could not get any traction. The fact that we were able to mobilize so many conservatives and get them to rally around this is an indication that this is now going to be the new litmus test, I think, for every 2024 presidential candidate and anybody who's running for Congress. They're going to be asked about this, and maybe there will be an effort in a future Congress to take action in the reverse and it restore some of that religious liberty protection that we really need.
Religious-affiliated schools and other nonprofit organizations who are governed by religious conviction should be paying very close attention. Bob Burney, my colleague, on 880 AM, The Word in Columbus, turned to Tim Throckmorton of the Family Research Council.
How bad is this legislation? The Democrats and even the 12 Republicans who voted for it said, well, you know, we're not really pushing same-sex marriage because there are tons of protections in this legislation to protect people who disagree, people who believe in traditional marriage, ministers, ministries, organizations. There is no way the federal government will ever trample on their personal religious convictions. I don't know about you, but I'm not believing that for a minute. Are you?
No, at FRC, we looked at this early on and said this is bad for a number of reasons. It will create, and this is with the amendments, not the Lee amendment, but the previously submitted amendments would create, even with them, would create a private right of action that would supercharge attacks on people and organizations that still believe in natural marriage, including people of faith who are already being attacked. It would tactically vilify millions of Americans who still believe in natural marriage by labeling that belief as sex discrimination tantamount to racism. Business owners will face costly litigation, and the tax-exempt status of faith-based nonprofits. Here, you know, they can say this is not going to affect pastors, and I don't believe it. You know, those promises are only as good as the first lawsuit and decision by a higher court. However, let's say that's the case. But it will affect, and this is where pastors must be aware of this, your congregation, those of you who are Christian business owners, it's going to change their life. Those of you who have folks in their church who do parachurch organization, foster care, child adoption, it's going to change their life. Yesterday morning, I heard a comment, Bob, that kind of took me back, and it was, you know, the comment was, I'm sure in 1973, there were many who were very concerned about the Roe versus Wade decision. They saw it for what it was, but there were a host of people who would not realize for some time, they could not envision the carnage that would take place because of the decision that happened then. This is one of those moments that's going to shape religious liberty or the lack thereof in our culture for generations.
Well, the Democrats and the Republicans who voted for it said, oh, no, no, there are provisions to protect churches. You will not lose your tax-exempt status over this. And yet Senator Langford offered an amendment that would actually specifically say your tax-exempt status will not be hurt. And that amendment was defeated 52-45. They're talking out of both sides of their mouth, Tim.
I know. It's quite weary to hear the deluge. Even after the vote, there were folks up there pontificating about this, you know, what this actually means that they already voted for. So, yeah. And you know, just here's a precursor. Judge Amy Coney Barrett, Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett, is under pressure to recuse herself because of an LGBT case. Because of her Catholic faith. Now, think about this. If you have a biblical worldview on life, human sexuality, marriage, you become questionable or potentially disqualified. Don't think that's not the nose of the camel under the tent. And as far as pastors, again, I heard the promises, but I still have a lot of questions. We do.
Well, in my contention when this thing was first proposed, but my contention was these so-called protections that the Republicans put into this bill are only as good as the first federal judge who ruled that portion of the bill unconstitutional. And we know that they're going to be able to find some whacked out liberal federal judge who will rule that portion, just that portion of the bill, unconstitutional. And so all of these assurances are meaningless. Am I over the top on that?
No, you are absolutely correct. That will be the case at some point as this begins to be employed. Then there are going to be that and other things that haven't been considered as of yet that will come up with religious organizations, religious freedom. And there's an end game here, and it's not stopping at the door of the church. Don't be fooled by that. Thomas Jefferson's words came before me as he was deeply concerned about some things that he had seen. And, you know, it's not, his fear was that, you know, there's a just God.
Yes.
And he recognized that. And this is a moment. I still have my hope in Christ. I still love the Lord, and I'm trusting in God. But for the future of this republic, it's I tremble, as Jefferson said, for my country.
Coming up, we'll look at how we got here and what it means.
The logic behind this kind of effort, and you see it in these Democratic statements, the logic behind it simply means there is basically a forfeiting of any claim to marriage as any kind of objective reality. It just means whatever some legislature, some culture may say, it means this for now, we'll see about later.
Albert Mohler, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy enters our 25th anniversary year, we've remained committed to a single truth of world history, that ideas have consequences. To understand these ideas and their impact on today's politics, and to test them quantitatively, requires the unique curriculum we offer on our Malibu, California campus. Apply now for fall classes at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. Those of you who have been tracking the way same-sex marriage policy has unfolded in our nation will remember well. The argument was, what does my right to marry who I want have to do with you? Well, I should point out, Jack Phillips, the Colorado cake maker, who's been in court for the greater part of the past 7 years since the Obergefell versus Hodges decision, won at the Supreme Court and is still being pursued in court by his opponents. And on Monday, web designer Lori Smith, she'll go before the Supreme Court with her own case, arguing that the government should not be able to compel her speech. And I could go on. We have reached this point very quickly. And here's Albert Mohler from his briefing program.
We're going back just to 1996. Bill Clinton was president of the United States. And Bill Clinton, now, of course, along with his wife, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, she was also the 2016 Democratic presidential nominee. Both Clintons now enthusiastic supporters of same-sex marriage. But back in 1996, it was Bill Clinton who signed into law the Defense of Marriage Act. The Defense of Marriage Act, by the way, simply stated that the federal government would not recognize any same-sex marriage, even if a state or numerous states might legalize, normalize, and recognize them. But, of course, looking back at this, the most important thing to understand is that this legislation passed 85-14 in the United States Senate. It passed so overwhelmingly that it would be very difficult to find a senator who would now admit having voted for it. But the same body, that is the same legislative body, the United States Senate, now voted to repeal this legislation and to celebrate it as a matter of moral change. So we're not looking at just a change, a modification, a new compass setting on this issue. We are looking at a 180-degree U-turn, an absolute reversal. And all of this has taken place just since 1996. Now, as I said, there were 12 Republicans who dared to vote for the measure. These would include Senators Roy Blunt of Missouri, Richard M. Burr, and Tom Tillis, both senators from North Carolina, Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, Susan Collins of Maine, Joni Ernst of Iowa, Cynthia Loomis of Wyoming, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Dan Sullivan, also of Alaska, Rob Portman of Ohio, Mitt Romney of Utah, and Todd Young of Indiana. Every single one of those Republicans voted to redefine marriage. They may try to say they were doing something else, but what they were actually doing is redefining marriage. Now, it's incredibly interesting to look at the comments made by Senator Loomis herself, again, Republican from Wyoming. She gave very interesting comments during the debate, and in her comments, she went on to make a distinction. She said there is a biblical definition of marriage, and there is what she called a secular definition of marriage. She went on to say the biblical definition of marriage as the union of a man and a woman. But she said that marriage now has the two meanings, the biblical and the secular, and she argued that it was perfectly consistent, it makes perfect sense to redefine marriage in secular law, while continuing, she said, to affirm what she calls biblical marriage in a biblical sense. Now, here's the problem. Once you describe a distinction between biblical marriage and secular marriage, as a matter of principle, you're arguing that secular marriage should be seen as something distinct from biblical marriage. Well, you have just separated, you have just unhitched or unhinged marriage from any objective definition in the Western moral tradition. You have just unhitched marriage from any consistent meaning of marriage that would go back not just a matter of a couple of centuries, but more than a couple of millennia. You are looking at an extremely radical moral act. But we're also looking at a real test case for the thinking of Christians as we try to think through these issues according to a Christian worldview. Is there some distinction between, say, how a church would define marriage and how a county or a state would define marriage? Well, yes, there is some distinction. But if that distinction becomes an absolute or radical distinction, then you can understand exactly where this is going. It is headed in the direction of those who hold to a biblical understanding of marriage as having to defend the right to hold to that understanding of marriage over against a very aggressive secular culture that's going to be saying, look, it's okay if you say inside your church walls, that's what marriage is. It's okay if inside your homes you want to say that's what marriage is, but you have no right to walk out in public and say that's what marriage is. By the way, Senator Loomis also said in her comments, quote, we do well by taking this step, not embracing or validating each other's devoutly held views, but by the simple act of tolerating them, end quote. You'll notice she says each other's devoutly held views. At least one thing we need to note is this. Until incredibly recently, and by that I mean in just the tiniest portion of human history, until very, very recently, not one major religious body of any form had endorsed anything like same-sex marriage. The Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Senator from New York, celebrated, of course, this legislative action. He went on to say, quote, the rights of all married couples will never truly be safe without the proper protections under federal law. And that's why the Respect for Marriage Act is necessary. That's what he said. On the Senate floor on Monday, he said, quote, passing this bill is our chance to send a message to Americans everywhere. No matter who you are, who you love, you deserve dignity and equal protection under the law. That's about as American an ideal as it comes, end quote. Just listen to that language. Let's look at the words as if he meant them seriously. This was intended to send a message to Americans everywhere, he said. No matter who you are, who you love, you deserve dignity and equal treatment under the law. I'm just going to state the obvious. Senator Schumer said that. He does not believe that. The key words there are no matter who you are, who you love, you deserve dignity and equal treatment under the law. I guarantee you that there are sexual relationships, there would even be forms of marriage, dare I say polygamy, that at least in official statements, Senator Schumer would have nonetheless no reluctance to condemn. He would condemn them, but he just said, no matter who you are, who you love, you deserve dignity and equal treatment under the law. What I want us to note in a worldview perspective is how language like that is offered and it is repeated in the media as if it makes sense when every sane person knows what was said isn't actually believed. One of the misspeakers in chief about all of this is none other than the President of the United States, Joe Biden, in a statement anticipating the Senate passage of this act. He said, quote, "The United States is on the brink of reaffirming a fundamental truth. Love is love, and Americans should have the right to marry the person they love," end quote. Well, Mr. President, let's just consider the logic of what you have just said, because the Democrats in the Senate have made very clear and even have adopted this amendment in order to say we don't mean polygamy. We don't mean that it can be more than two people, but we are going to redefine marriage no longer to mean a man and a woman. Now it can mean a man and a man or a woman and a woman. And of course, given the non-binary category, who knows all that it might mean. Two individuals, by the way, is the way some of this language is expressed. Just two individuals, man and woman, simply disappear. But the president said love is love. Well, again, Mr. President, I don't believe you actually mean that. Or if you do mean that, you ought to have the courage to tell the American people you mean that. No boundaries whatsoever. No definitional requirements whatsoever. Love is love. But the bigger point here is that it's not just a matter of loose language among the proponents of this bill. It's a matter of the fact that if you decouple marriage from an objective reality, an objective definition, if you separate it from creation and ontology, that is to say, being as God has created it, then marriage inevitably, if it can mean some other thing, will mean many other things. The only constraint on how many other things it might eventually mean, the only constraint is whatever residual sanity remains in society. But as we have seen, in just one generation, you can't count on much of that sanity continuing at all. And furthermore, the logic behind this kind of effort, and you see it in these Democratic statements, the logic behind it simply means there is basically a forfeiting of any claim to marriage as any kind of objective reality. It just means whatever some legislature, some court, some culture may say, it means this for now, and it means this for us. We'll see about later.
Coming up, rediscovering conservatism.
What would it look like to actually conserve something?
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. The radical and revolutionary agenda we're facing in our nation has forced many people to wake up and push back. But as we push back, there's a right-leaning subsection that doesn't always align with conservative values. Our next guest has made a case for grounded conservatism in his book, Conservatism, a Rediscovery. Yerome Hazony, an Orthodox Jew, joined our friend Albert Mohler, an evangelical Christian, on his podcast, Thinking in Public.
Why this particular book at this time?
Well, I've been involved with conservative things most of my adult life. I mean, since I was in college, even a little bit before. And I have this feeling that in a lot of ways, times have become more desperate than they've ever been on the one hand. And on the other hand, the clarity of the conservative message, I think, has faded to the point that it's very uncertain how are conservatives supposed to offer aid and assistance in very, very difficult times, you know, both in the United States and in other democratic countries in Europe and elsewhere. And one thing that I know that especially the younger people who have some kind of an impulse in the direction of conservatism or the right more broadly, I think that one thing we hear from them all the time is, what is conservatism ever conserved? It's not intended to be a hostile remark, although sometimes it sounds like that. I think it's a genuine question. If we look at the last couple of generations and we see the way in which Western nations have abandoned God and Scripture, but also family and loyalty to the nation, to the independence of nations, at this point, man and woman, honor and sanctity. I mean, the Sabbath, you can just go on and on. I think it's completely reasonable to ask, what is conservatism conserved? And the purpose of this book, you know, rather than being an apology for, you know, how great conservatism has been in recent years, what I try to do is to ask what I think is the necessary question. What would it look like to actually conserve something, to actually construct a society and, in fact, individual personal lives that would be capable of conserving things?
And I want to ask, what happened that led you to believe this book really needed to enter the public conversation at this time?
I think you're describing it all correctly. I mean, my first book is already 20 years old. It was called The Jewish State, The Struggle for Israel's Soul. And at that time, America looked really sturdy and Europe looked okay, too, and in a lot of ways. And the State of Israel, which is, you know, I live with my wife and kids in Jerusalem, and that's where we make our home. And the State of Israel seemed like it was on the edge. And the question that I addressed in that first book was, where have all the traditions gone? You know, there was this new liberalism that was making life in Israel, to my mind, unrecognizable and dangerously so. So that's actually where I began the conversation. And it's a little strange, but now 20 years later, it feels as though those same issues, which were so troubling about Israel, have overtaken America. And, you know, obviously Israel is a small country. It's very different from the United States in a lot of ways. But at the same time, there is something that that unites all of the Western democracies, all of the nations that have in one way or another come out of this great Anglo-American tradition of biblical religion and nationalism. And we all are facing a common opponent that is mutating and getting, you know, more difficult to handle with every passing year. I think that we can say that in 2020, I think it's fair to say that in 2020 was a watershed, and it might have been a watershed even without the coronavirus. The main reason 2020 was a watershed is because the hegemony of liberal ideas, the political conditions in which you could count on most people of the left and the right to agree on certain basic liberal premises, which had been agreed upon, you know, basically since World War II, that came to an end in 2020. I mean, I'm not the liberalism is still a very powerful framework, but I think realistically, it is being severely challenged and successfully from the left by this kind of neo-Marxist wokeism. And I also think that many non-liberal views, some of them are positive and some of them are positively awful, are also appearing on the right. And in a way, everything is up for grabs now. The traditions have really been worn down to the point that almost anything can happen. And so I felt, you know, this is just, it's the last moment to be able to write this book and publish it and feel like I put out there what I have to say.
Coming up,
it's two generations after God and Bible were asked to remove themselves from the American public schools. And people can't tell the difference between a man and a woman anymore.
More on conservatism, a rediscovery, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Stay with us.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy enters our 25th anniversary year, we've remained committed to a single truth of world history, that ideas have consequences.
To understand these ideas and their impact on today's politics, and to test them quantitatively, requires the unique curriculum we offer on our Malibu, California campus. Apply now for fall classes at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. In his new book, Conservatism, A Rediscovery, Yaron Hazony has done some significant work on what it means to be a conservative, including making the necessary distinction between a conservative and a classical liberal, a label that's often used to refer to our nation with an emphasis on individual freedom and liberty. Let's continue with more of the conversation with Yaron Hazony, a guest of Albert Mohler, on his Thinking in Public podcast.
I want to come back to two arguments made in your book. You go at the fact that the conservatism and classical liberalism are not the same thing, and that this is a confusing issue. It was very confusing to me as a teenager. I could understand the claims of classical liberty, but by the time you got even to the Reagan years, there were people saying, you know, we're the true liberals. I mean, even Reagan played with that a little bit himself, having been a liberal Democrat at one point. We're the true liberals. You know, this classic liberal tradition. And one of the things I most appreciate about your indictment is that you go right at John Locke in terms of Locke's understanding that the only binding relationships on earth are those of consent. I mean, that destroys civilization. It doesn't further it.
Yeah. Again, I think there's a lot of people who just get upset because you're just not supposed to criticize Locke. It's an image of the American founding that was born in the 1940s, 1950s, which says this isn't a nation with traditions many centuries old. It's an idea that was invented by brilliant people during the Enlightenment, meaning to say, you know, in the 1700s, human beings for the first time in history figured out, you know, the great truths that are universally true. Before then, it was all basically darkness. And so that picture turns Locke and Kant and Spinoza and Rousseau's On the Social Contract. It turns, you'll think I'm exaggerating, it actually turns these books into a new scripture. And the books are used in schools, you know, of course, if schools where Bible and God are no longer taught. These books are used in high schools, in universities, to advance a new religion, which has no need for scripture and no need for tradition and no need for God. Now, I'm not saying, you know, that was John Locke's goal. That would be a preposterous thing to say. You know, again, I think Locke has a place, is a place in the American founding and the Anglo-American tradition, but you can't turn him into a prophet. You can't turn his view of reason into God himself or into God's word. That's a step that is, it's not just too far. It puts an end to the entire tradition. And I think we don't have any choice but respectfully to resist this.
And in a Lockean sense, you know, if everything comes down to consent, and the consent of the governed, which means not just the government, but I think in the larger sense, consent to the culture, then we're just going to have to figure out how we can give enough consent to try to bring out the better thing. So you and I both know people who claim the conservative mantle, who made the argument that we should adopt and endorse same-sex marriage, because after all, marriage is a conserving institution, and the liberation of sexual impulses is a given now. So all we need to do is, and must do, or can do, is to try to restrain that within certain bounds. I think both of us would agree. Marriage can't be anything other than the union of a man and a woman.
Yes, certainly.
And consent to that could be something else actually won't make it something else. You know, I think an awful lot of people that used to be called conservative are now just living in an intellectually foolish dream.
You know, this issue of consent, it's already taken up by Selden and Hale and other. I mean, we're talking about, you know, many centuries ago that great English Protestant statesmen took up the question of, can our society really be based on consent? And their argument was that if the only thing that's holding together our society is consent, then you also have to say that when you stop consenting, then the force of those obligations stops. I think that argument was being made at the very dawn of liberalism by conservatives. And I don't think it's ever been responded to. There has to be something other than the consenting individual. If it's only the consenting individual, then you've turned the consenting individual into God. He alone decides what obliges him. The theory of consent is taught as though it's a theory of moral obligation, but it's not. It's a theory of the freedom from moral obligation.
Right. And if you extend that beyond the individual and you say the consent, say, of groups or societies, again, consent can only get you so far. Because, again, you can consent to the fact that people are pregnant, but that doesn't make people pregnant. And so, you know, I see these toxins release, especially among younger Americans or younger people in the Western world. They're fed this ideology of liberation in which consent is, whether it's sex or for that matter, anything else or government, that's all that matters. But, you know, they can get together and consent to whatever they may choose. That doesn't change reality.
Yep. You know, reality, as I understand it, it's not only about what objects there are. It's also about what obligations you have. There are versions of this argument that try to avoid God. You hear this in academia that, you know, well, we have the natural law and it obligates us. So, you know, the beauty of it is you don't really need God. And I really think that's a mistake. It's a mistake because, again, this is going back to this issue of, you know, how smart are we? I think we just need more humility about our ability to figure it all out. The place that God plays in sort of the economy of a religious person's thoughts is that whenever you have a principle that you're tempted to say, wow, I know this for absolute certain. I can just rule the world on the basis of this principle because it's so obviously true. A religious person bumps into God and feels, you know, I'm just going too far. I just can't know that much. There's a point at which I have to say that there are things that are beyond me. And God in the scriptural tradition, people talk about the guide rails are coming off. And the reason the guide rails are coming off is because those guide rails were the tradition of common sense that we inherited through thousands of years of studying scripture and placing ourselves in a humble relationship with the God of scripture. And you can't just do without it. I mean, here we are. It's two generations after God and Bible were asked to remove themselves from the American public schools, and people can't tell the difference between a man and a woman anymore. You have to think about that. I mean, people are using reason. You can't say they're not reasoning. You know, all these professors writing these theories, they have reason coming out of their ears. The problem is not that they're not reasoning. The problem is that their reason is detached from any kind of humility about the demands of reality, right, as you say, but also about the demands of a God who knows a thing or two that we don't know.
Coming up, what are we conserving?
The real test of whether you're a conservative is if you're a conservative person.
A few more minutes with Jerome Hazzoni when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. As we consider the book Conservatism, A Rediscovery, and Jerome Hazzoni's efforts to renew our understanding of a grounded conservatism, the obvious question is, what am I conserving? And am I playing a part in conserving what is right and good? Well, let's pick up with more of the conversation between Albert Mohler and Jerome Hazzoni.
The bravest argument you make in your book is not the argument for nationalism. It is not the argument for the Anglo-American conservative tradition. The bravest argument you make in your book is one that I have not seen anyone make in decades, and that is that conservatism requires conservative lives. I'd really invite you to spell that out just a bit.
Well, another part of the liberal framework is this idea that government is one thing and individuals, private individuals, are another thing, and there's no connection between them. That just isn't true. Government and society are completely intertwined. There is no way to separate them. And what that means is that, you know, we have a whole generation of very well-meaning conservative activists who think that if they stand up for, I don't know, let's say pro-family policies or oppose abortion. I mean, these are obviously important things, but they think that if they're speaking on the right side and if they're, you know, holding the right signs, then they're conservatives. But there is no separation between public life and private life. The real test of whether you're a conservative is if you're a conservative person, if you're leaving a conservative life. Either you are plugged into a society. At this point, it's usually an Orthodox Christian congregation or Orthodox Jewish congregation. Either you're plugged into the chain of transmission so that older people who are handing down things, genuine things from the past that they know about, are there to teach you. Either you're there and receiving it, or you're not actually a conservative. You're a liberal with some conservative opinions. And I think that the argument about what public policy needs to be, it has to happen. But the real argument, the real decisive place where the future of American Western democracy is going to be decided is when these young people in their 30s who want to save their country, their tradition, but are living completely liberal lives. You know, they just keep putting off getting married, and they keep putting off having children. And, serving in the military is just too much of a burden. And, they would feel like complete jokers if they actually opened the Bible and studied it. All of this, it has a huge, huge impact. A person who is not plugged into the tradition, not part of the chain of transmission, doesn't really know what a conservative is.
Thank you for joining us for the Christian Outlook. If you enjoyed the program, be sure to mention it to a friend and send them to thechristianoutlook.com. Encourage them to sign up for our podcast. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers David Pouchon, Tim Grantner, and James Blend, I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook. She expected the world,
but it flew away from a real... 3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.